You're listening to The Globalist, first broadcast on the 24th of April 2024 on Monocle Radio. The Globalist, in association with UBS. It's 1500 in Seoul, 8 a.m. in Warsaw, 7 a.m. here in London, and 2 a.m. in New York. You're listening to Monocle Radio. The Globalist starts now. Hello, this is The Globalist, broadcasting to you live from Midori House in London. I'm Georgina Godwin. On the show ahead...
The 10,000 NATO troops based here in Poland send an unmistakable message that NATO will protect and defend all allies.
Poland flexes its diplomatic muscle as it hosts NATO's Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg and British Prime Minister Rishi Sunak to talk defence and security in the region. We'll get the latest on the criminal trial of Donald Trump as his lawyer is warned he's losing all credibility within the court. In Taiwan, moves are afoot to remove hundreds of statues of the late Chinese dictator Chiang Kai-shek. But with whole parks dedicated to him, how will this change the landscape? Then...
I've seen price caps introduced many, many times over the years. They're always well-intentioned. The intent ultimately is to provide more access to fans to get into events. Unfortunately, price caps don't work.
We'll look at the future of ticket resales. We'll also have a roundup from the world of aviation, have a browse through the front pages, and finally, we'll hear the details of a lost painting by Gustav Klimt, now found and up for auction. That's all ahead here on The Globalist, live from London. First, a look at what else is happening in the news. Last night, a sweeping foreign aid package easily passed the US Congress after months of delay, clearing the way for billions of dollars in fresh Ukraine funding amid advances from Russia and Kyiv's shortages of military supplies. UN Rights Chief Volker Turk said yesterday he was horrified by the destruction of Nasser and al-Shifa medical facilities in Gaza and reports of mass graves containing hundreds of bodies there. And hundreds of thousands of Argentinians took to the streets of Buenos Aires on Tuesday in an anti-government march against budget cuts to public universities, the biggest protest yet against President Javier Milei's painful austerity measures. Do stay tuned to Monocle Radio throughout the day for more on those stories. Now, Poland has been enjoying some high-profile visitors of late, not just because of the country's proximity to Ukraine, but possibly because of the diplomatic skills of its leader, Donald Tusk. The Prime Minister also served as the President of the European Council and enjoys a good relationship with most Western leaders. Yesterday, both the NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg and the British Prime Minister Rishi Sunak were in Warsaw for talks with Tusk. Well, I'm joined now by Mateusz Muzyny, who is a writer-at-large at Gazeta Wyborska and a lecturer in journalism at Collegium Civitas in Warsaw. Mateusz, very good to have you back with us. Is this a concerted diplomatic effort by Tusk? Is he positioning himself to be an unelected head of Europe?
To a certain extent, Georgina. I think it's just a linear, very steady continuation of this rather proactive stance in foreign policy that both Tusk and the head of Polish Foreign Ministry, Radek Sikorski, assumed ever since they returned to power last December following the victory in parliamentary elections in October. We obviously had the British Prime Minister Rishi Sunak here in Warsaw yesterday, as together with Jens Stoltenberg, the Secretary General of NATO. But that's just the latest chapter of a very long list of diplomatic engagements, both domestically and internationally. So within just the span of a few months, we have had the reactivation of the Weimar Triangle. So this diplomatic tripartite format between France, Germany and Poland that already held two meetings. We had a visit by both President Andrzej Duda and Donald Tusk to the White House to meet both with American congressmen and Joe Biden himself. Other leaders came to Poland as well, including Kaja Kallas, the Estonian Prime Minister, who is widely rumored to be among the front runners to replace Stoltenberg as the head of NATO this October. So to a certain extent, yes, I think Donald Tusk, as you've mentioned, a very experienced leader and a very experienced politician also on the European stage, is rallying the troops on the one hand and definitely trying to get to strengthen the support of European countries towards Ukraine. But on the other hand, he is very much a different politician the last time compared to the last time European leaders dealt with him as Prime Minister of Poland. Much more sovereign, much more decisive, much more steady in negotiations with Europe.
Now, you mentioned his joint visit to the White House with Andrzej Duda, who's Poland's president. He's backed by the Law and Justice Party. And of course, he is Tusk's arch enemy, really, in domestic politics. How difficult is it for him and Sikorski to enact their policies because of Duda?
It's certainly a challenge because Duda, representing the populist nationalist Law and Justice, is not entirely a pro-European politician and not entirely a major supporter of Biden administration. In fact, he traveled himself on a sort of unofficial, sort of official visit to see Donald Trump, which is not really something that happens on the highest levels of diplomatic relationships, especially considering the ongoing presidential campaign in the United States. So now, according to the Polish legal framework, especially the Polish constitution, it is the prime minister who decides the overall direction of foreign policy, but he has to do it in accordance and coordination with the president. The president has formally the power to accept nominations for ambassadors, which is a very hotly contested issue among the Polish political scene right now, because obviously Sikorski would like a very swift turnover of over 50 ambassadors, and Duda is not entirely convinced this is necessary and is blocking some of the major appointments that Sikorski is putting forward right now.
So let's talk about this three-way meeting with Sunak and Stoltenberg. What was discussed?
Well, Sunak came to Poland to announce another installment of the British aid to Ukraine, which is totaling £500 million and obviously includes a lot of military hardware. We have had mentioned the long-range Storm Shadow missiles, the Husky armored vehicles, and numerous other high-grade military pieces of equipment and military technology. But I think what's very important in this context, also because Stoltenberg was here, is the fact that Poland doesn't actually limit itself to increasing its negotiating and diplomatic power within the European Union. We remember that obviously Britain is outside of the Union right now, but remains a very staunch supporter of Ukraine within NATO. Now, there are some unofficial rumors that it might be actually Sikorski himself to attempt to become NATO Secretary General. He's also rumored to be potentially the first European Union Defense Commissioner, should that post actually be established following the June European Parliament elections. So maybe some behind the scenes talks took place also to elevate the profile of the Polish foreign minister. But in the grand scheme of things, I think this is just an effort to solidify the position of Poland as the main advocate of Ukraine vis-à-vis both NATO and European Union, and also to show to the domestic public, because at the end of the day, all politics is always domestic politics. So I think both Sikorski and Tusk are trying to show their native electorate, which is more urban, middle class, pro-European, and liberal, that they are doing all that's within their power to make Poland return to the negotiation table in Europe.
You talk about the EU and how united they are. We know that Brussels has put forward a 1.5 billion euro strategy to set up defence production. I wonder if that's enough, if it's going forward, and what more NATO is offering.
Well, I'm certainly convinced that this is not going to be enough. And in fact, Poland is one of those countries that falls victim of these shortcomings of defense production and defense capacity in Europe. Poland has invested a lot of money to actually improve the quality of its military hardware, mostly buying equipment from South Korea. And the reason for that is very simple. South Korea and the United States are perhaps the two countries that are offering off-the-shelf solutions. So, in other words, even if Poland wanted to, for instance, I don't know, establish military trade relations with France, it would have to wait 5 to 7 to 10 years for any deliveries to materialize. The South Korean equipment is readily available, but whether the whole modernization process will actually go ahead, that still remains to be seen, because a very early review of the new government concerning the spending plan left behind by the Law and Justice government discovered that there is almost a 40 billion euro gap in what was planned to be purchased and what the funds allow for. So whether Poland will come up with the necessary money, that is still uncertain. And also quickly, another thing that I don't think we talk enough about is the shortage of military personnel. So Poland aims to have a professional army of 300,000 people by the end of this decade. Right now it's somewhere around 180,000, so it should be recruiting at the pace of several thousand a year, and it's nowhere near that level. Poles are not really eager to go and serve in the military, and I think that's a widespread problem across the whole continent. So we might have the latest equipment, we really might have the modern technology, but will we have enough people to operate them? That's a big question.
Is there conscription in Poland?
Not anymore, and Poles are not in support of that idea. A recent poll from last month by an Ibris research house revealed that 41% of those polled were categorically against the idea of compulsory conscription and compulsory military service. And also civil defense in Poland is something that the country struggles with in terms of building a very strong link between the resilient civil society and the professional army. Because we know that in the event of a direct invasion, should that be from Russia or any other country for that matter, it's never going to be enough just to ask the professional soldiers to defend your country. And I think Ukraine proves that point beyond a shred of doubt.
Mateusz, thank you very much indeed. That's Mateusz Mazini talking to us from Warsaw. And this is The Globalist. It is 12 minutes past 2 a.m. in New York. That's 7:12 here in London. The criminal trial of former U.S. President Donald Trump began on Monday. Trump's pleaded not guilty to 34 counts of falsifying business records to cover up an affair with a porn star just weeks before the 2016 election. Well, I'm joined now by Natasha Lindstad, who's Professor of Government at the University of Essex, to look back at the first 2 days of the trial. Natasha, many thanks for joining us. What were the key takeaways from the opening statements at the trial?
Well, I think it was really interesting. If you look at the opening statements, I mean, the prosecutors were laying out the case of what Donald Trump did to falsify business records by making this in order to cover up this payment to, I guess it went directly through Michael Cohen, his fixer, who ended up going to prison for several years. It was sentenced to prison for 3 years to pay Stormy Daniels off, and how this really defrauded voters, that this actually did have victims. It wasn't a victimless crime here, and it really shaped the 2016 election. It shaped the outcome of the 2016 election. Whereas Donald Trump's defense team was basically saying that he didn't do anything wrong. He didn't, that it's, there's nothing wrong with paying someone to be quiet, paying someone hush money, that there's, you know, nothing to see here, and that this is a complete witch hunt. And if we look at the trial from yesterday, a lot of the focus was on David Pecker, who was the head of the National Enquirer, a very close personal friend of Donald Trump, who was detailing the catch and kill process, where it was a strange sort of journalistic habit of buying stories and then burying them. And he talked a lot about his friendship with Donald Trump and what that relationship meant and how they plotted to affect the 2016 election by planting stories that were very negative about his opponent, Hillary Clinton, while also promoting stories that were positive about Donald Trump. And then, of course, killing any story that could be damaging to him. And then a lot of the focus was also on this, the problem that Trump just keeps talking and saying horrible things about everybody, including Judge Mershon, And so there was a bit of sparring between the defense team of Trump and the judge about a gag order and that Trump could be caught in contempt of court.
Because he's breached that order several times, hasn't he?
He has. I mean, I don't think any other individual could get away with what Trump is getting away with. When you're on trial, you're not supposed to be speaking negatively about the trial itself. You're not supposed to be talking about the trial. You're definitely not supposed to be speaking negatively about the justice system and the judge. But Trump has breached this many times, and he seems to be able to get away with it. But Mershon has warned that he's losing all credibility, or at least the lawyer. He said the defense team is losing credibility with the court and that this has to stop.
And because Trump, of course, he's putting all of this out on his social media account, Truth Social. But in court, he is forced to be silent. How is he taking that?
Well, he's finding it very difficult, according to those that were observing him, that he mostly stays silent, although there was a few moments where he was animated, but he has to listen to it. And I think one of the interesting things was early on in the selection of the jury, he had to listen to all these terrible things about him because they were trying to select unbiased members of the jury, horrible tweets and social media tweets that potential jury members had said about him. And he was there forced to kind of face these very negative depictions of him, and he couldn't really say anything.
Let's talk a little bit about Michael Cohen, because, of course, he is the prosecution's star witness, once a very close ally of Trump. What is he likely to do on the stand?
Well, he'll just explain what Trump told him to do. And as I mentioned, Michael Cohen was sentenced to 3 years in prison for making this hush money payment was basically a violation of campaign finance laws. And he'll explain what he has done for Trump for many, many years, that he is his fixer, being basically asked to do illegal things, which he did out of loyalty to Trump. And he'll explain that he was not the person who made this decision. It was Trump who directed him to do so. And I think that will be compelling for the jury because they have to remember that if Michael Cohen went to prison for basically being the underling of Donald Trump, then why shouldn't Trump face some sort of prison time or at least be convicted of a crime here in this instance?
So what's Trump's defense saying about Cohen?
Well, they're trying to destroy his credibility, tell the court that he's basically a liar, that you can't trust anything he says. And that way, by doing that, by casting doubt in what he says, because he is the star witness for the prosecution, of course, then that basically throws out all the information that he's providing about all the different things that Trump has done. And Cohen has like a mountain of information of, you know, illegal activities that Trump has done, which if that comes to light, of course, portrays a pattern of criminality by Trump. And so they'll try to undermine that.
And what about Stormy Daniels, the porn star at the center of this, or adult actress at the center of this? Is she likely to take the stand? And how is she being discredited by Trump's legal team?
Right. I mean, I would think that it's possible that she could take the stand. She's being discredited, but for being a liar. Similar tactics that they're using with Michael Cohen. In the U.S. media, both Michael Cohen and Stormy Daniels have been very prominently featured, particularly Michael Cohen. But there was a period there that Stormy Daniels was on every talk show. I would think it would be almost impossible for these jury members to have not heard some of the stories of Stormy Daniels. And she has depicted everything about their encounter and what happened and all the fallout and so forth. She hadn't been in the public eye for a while, but she was all over the American media.
So Trump's lawyers said there's nothing wrong with trying to influence an election. It's called democracy. How would you rate the lawyer's performance? It has been called meandering.
Oh, it sounds crazy. But I think that's the only defense that they have, is to say that this is, I mean, this is one of the things that Trump, I guess, is so brilliant at, and what his lawyers have taken on to is to basically take the facts and say, oh, this is all fine, to turn it on its head, that, you know, and we're seeing this in the other case where he's fighting for immunity from any kind of criminal activity. that he's saying that this was all perfectly fine because he did it in defense of democracy. So he's taking some kind of perverse definition of democracy, trying to use it to his advantage, and then trying to act like everybody else around him, all the institutions, are crazy. So I can't imagine that this defense is going to go well with jury members, but it's got to go well with everybody when you have a jury.
Mm. How long is the case likely to last?
And that's a good question. I really don't know. I think that Judge Merchan has been trying to move it along. And so it could be over in weeks, maybe a few months. I think the likelihood of it being over before Trump tries to get the nomination from the Republican Party this summer is high. I think it's likely to be over by then.
I mean, most analysts are saying that it probably won't carry a jail term. But as you point out, if Cohen is already serving time because of exactly the same thing, how does that make sense?
It doesn't make any sense. I mean, it could carry a jail term of 4 years, but it's unlikely that the jury is going to decide that. Honestly, we've had issues with picking jury members because they're worried about their own safety, their own personal safety. And I think that that's one of the aspects of the justice system that is really unfair, that Donald Trump has been treated completely differently than any other human being. He acts as if he's the biggest victim, but we're not treating him the same way. The person who was basically just doing what he was told to do faced prison time. And had to face at least a couple years in prison and then house arrest after that. Donald Trump probably isn't going to face prison time because people are worried about the fallout. And that's, of course, a breach of the rule of law.
Natasha, thank you very much indeed. Natasha Lindstad there. Now, still to come on the programme, we get the latest news from the world of aviation and find out all about a long-lost Klimt painting, which is about to be auctioned. This is The Globalist.
UBS has over 900 investment analysts from over 100 different countries.
Over 900 of the sharpest minds and freshest thinkers in the world of finance today.
To find out how we could help you,
contact us at ubs.com.
You're with The Globalist on Monocle Radio. Let's continue now with today's newspapers. Joining me in the studio is Phil Clark, Professor of International Politics at SOAS, University of London. Welcome back, Phil.
Good morning, Georgina.
Now, we're going to start with a piece in the Financial Times saying that Israel has not provided evidence to support the UNRWA claims. These are claims that Israel says that these human rights workers are in fact members of Hamas.
Indeed. The listeners will probably remember that a few months back, Israel made this accusation that UN humanitarian workers were members of Hamas and other terrorist organisations. Within a matter of days, the 16 countries that fund the UN Humanitarian Refugee Agency for Palestine pulled $450 million of funding for that organisation. It's an organisation that provides really essential humanitarian services to Palestinian refugees, not just in Gaza and the West Bank, but across the wider region. As a result of that funding being pulled, UNRWA had to remove most of its 13,000 staff on the ground. So it completely shut down humanitarian services for many Palestinians. But it has come to light now through this independent UN investigation, in fact, that there's almost no evidence to substantiate the Israeli claims that these staff were members of Hamas. So it does seem that the international community has reacted on the basis of really flimsy evidence from Israel here.
Although the organisation did say that it had fired several employees as a result.
Indeed. And I think that was part of the PR move by UNRWA at the time to try to deal with this situation. They found several staff that they thought may have been acting suspiciously. They removed them. I think there was a hope that that might nip this situation in the bud. That didn't affect the funding situation. Those 16 countries went ahead and pulled their funding anyway. And I suspect we'll hear more about those three staff members. It turns out they may have been unfairly maligned in all of this.
Let's move to Australia now and the antics of Elon Musk, always entertaining, sometimes dangerous. What's he up to now?
There's a huge fight going on between Musk and the Australian government at the moment, Georgina. This is all over the Australian papers, but Reuters, I think, is covering this piece particularly well today. The background here is that there was a stabbing in a Sydney church about a week ago, and Australia has quite strict social media laws. Australia has an individual termed the E-Safety Commissioner, and she put out an edict over the weekend saying that all social media companies that had been allowing videos of the stabbing incident on their platforms needed to pull those down. Now, most of the companies in question complied, Facebook, Instagram, etc., but Elon Musk and X refused to take down their videos, which meant that on Monday night in Australia, the federal court had to rule that if X did not take the videos down, there would be substantial fines attached to the company. Now, this has now exploded out into the political arena. The Australian Prime Minister, Anthony Albanese, yesterday said that Trump was acting like an arrogant billionaire who thinks that he's above the law.
Musk.
Musk, sorry. Yeah, I'm getting my right-wing demagogues mixed up here this morning. And Musk then retorted by saying that this was a fascist government that was clamping down on free speech. He also criticised Australia's very strict gun laws. This was completely separate, I think, to this case. But I guess the big question here is around the regulation of social media platforms, particularly in the context of violence and the likelihood that such videos of this stabbing could be used to incite further violence. Musk is trying to make this a freedom of speech question. The Australian government is trying to make this about a kind of a safe regulation of the social media space question.
And Musk, of course, has form on going after individuals, doesn't he? And he's done this in this case.
Indeed. So he's particularly targeted one Australian senator, Jackie Lambie, who's for about 2 years now been very vocal on this social media question. She had tweeted yesterday that she thought that Musk should be in jail. Musk retorted by saying that she was the one who should be locked up, and he called her an enemy of the people of Australia. So this situation is particularly barbed. The other thing that's in the background to all of this is that there is new legislation being that is being considered in the Australian Parliament at the moment to fine social media companies for allowing disinformation or misinformation to remain on their platform. So if deliberate disinformation is pointed out to them, they have an obligation to pull it down, and if they don't, they're subject potentially to million or billion dollar fines. And so Musk, I'm sure, is worried about that type of legislation in the background. So there's this immediate situation about the stabbing video, but there's a kind of bigger legislative question in the background here. Mm.
Now, much to discuss about the UK's Rwanda migration deal. This, of course, has just passed, but whether it will actually happen or not is still very much up in the air.
Indeed. And so I've been looking at the Rwandan newspapers on this, Georgina. Clearly, there's been a huge amount of discussion in the last couple of days in the British press about this migration deal passing through Parliament, and now looks like it will happen with Rwanda. But the reaction in Rwanda has been very interesting. I think that looking at the Rwandan newspapers today and looking at listening to Rwandan radio, there's a very muted response about the deal. There's huge fanfare here in the UK. It's the front page news on every newspaper. In Rwanda, there's almost a sense of resignation, a sense of the UK has made such a mess of this deal. It's been so slow. It's been so laborious. And in the process, some quite outrageous things about Rwanda have been said in the UK Parliament and in the UK media. There's a kind of a weary reaction, I think, in Rwanda. And one of the other reactions, and I'm looking at a piece in the New Times, which is the state-owned newspaper in Rwanda, a real sense now still that the deal may not go through. So a real sense of we'll believe it when we see it. I think the Rwandan response is, look, we're ready to take asylum seekers and refugees, but we still don't quite believe that the UK system will make this happen. And so we're not going to get too worked up about it because we don't really believe that the Brits will be able to follow through on this. So just a very different type of media response in Rwanda from what we're seeing in the UK at the moment.
And is Rwanda ready to take refugees? What kind of facilities exist?
They've got a long track record of looking after refugees. Rwanda has 130,000 Burundian Congolese refugees in the country at the moment, and most of them have been there for 10 or 15 years. So there is a very elaborate refugee infrastructure, if you like, to deal with those who come from the UK. I mean, I think as a Rwanda specialist, one of the things I've been at pains to say all the way through this debate is that I've never thought that the problem was with Rwanda. I've never thought that the issue was the safety of asylum seekers in Rwanda. I think the problem is that the UK has an obligation to look after refugees and asylum seekers on its own shores, and it shouldn't be outsourcing this to any third-party state. But there has all along, I think, been a sense in Rwanda of this is the UK's problem. This deal needs to be worked out in the UK. We're ready to deal with it here. But a sense that this still may not ever happen. A real scepticism in Rwanda, I think, about this deal.
And indeed here in Britain too.
Indeed. And I guess the backdrop to all of it is a feeling that this is quite a desperate move by Rishi Sunak as Prime Minister, a real hope that this Rwanda deal is the thing that might save the Tories at the general election whenever Sunak decides to hold that election. But even if the planes take off and start landing in Kigali, I don't think that's going to be enough to save the Tories here.
Finally, let's go back to Australia. I love this story. Australian medical workers have asked bite victims to stop bringing their snakes to hospital.
Look, as an Australian, I feel like I should never be shocked by the sorts of things that happen in my home country, but this story is an absolute beauty. It's on the UPI news website. I didn't know that this was a thing, but apparently it is a thing that increasingly snake bite victims in Australia are not only turning up at hospitals looking for treatment, but they're bringing the actual snakes with them. And this particular story was off the back of a man turning up at Bundaberg Hospital in Queensland with the eastern brown snake that had bitten him, and he had it in what was described in this news piece as a flimsy plastic container. Now, you might think that this was a one-off, and so this is a sort of a freak show article, but the piece continues with warnings from Queensland medical specialists suggesting that this has been going on for quite a long time, that people keep turning up with the animal that has attacked them, leading one major hospital to now post on Twitter that if you have been bitten by a snake, you should not use a tourniquet, you should not try to suck the venom out of the wound, and you should not bring the snake into hospital that has bitten you. So it's now part of the normal protocol, apparently, to have to warn people against this kind of thing.
But surely the reason they're doing that is because the snake needs to be identified so they can get the correct treatment. Is there another way of doing that?
Apparently so. So the piece also, I mean, it's a wonderful article. It also quotes a Queensland snake catcher who says, look, you know, I'm an expert in this area. Hospital staff don't know anything about snakes, but what they're very good at is detecting the type of anti-venom that you need. So there are a whole lot of sophisticated tests that can be undertaken in the hospital to work out what snake has bitten you and what kind of anti-venom you need. It took a snake catcher to inform the Australian public that expertise already exists in the hospital system. You don't actually have to bring the snake with you.
Phil, thank you very much indeed. That's Phil Clark there. Now, here's what else we're keeping an eye on today. Last night, a sweeping foreign aid package easily passed the US Congress after months of delay, clearing the way for billions of dollars in fresh Ukraine funding amid advances from Russia and Kyiv's shortage of military supplies. The Senate approved four bills passed by the House of Representatives on Saturday after House Republican leaders abruptly switched course last week and allowed a vote on the $95 billion in mostly military aid for Ukraine, Israel and Taiwan and US partners in the Indo-Pacific. UN Rights Chief Volker Turk said yesterday he was horrified by the destruction of the Nasser and Al-Shifa medical facilities in Gaza and reports of mass graves. Palestinian authorities reported finding hundreds of bodies buried by Nasser Hospital in Khan Yunis this week after it was abandoned by Israeli troops. Bodies were also reported at the Al-Shifa site following an Israeli special forces operation. And hundreds of thousands of Argentinians took to the streets of Buenos Aires on Tuesday in an anti-government march against budget cuts to public universities, the biggest protest yet against President Javier Milei's painful austerity measures. The demonstrations are the latest example of rising tension over spending cuts that are helping undo a deep fiscal deficit but causing hardship in the real economy. This is The Globalist. Stay tuned. ...2024 is to continue to be a bumper year for music fans, with global superstars like Taylor Swift, Bruce Springsteen, Green Day and Stevie Nicks all on tour. With such a demand for tickets, many consumers have been turning to the ticket resale marketplace, prompting the UK Labour leader, Sir Keir Starmer, to say he would cap ticket resale prices if he became Prime Minister. Chris Miller, managing director of Viagogo, a multinational ticket exchange company, came to Midori House to speak to Monocle's Tom Webb on why this would be a disaster for the business and music fans alike.
Viagogo was started in 2006 here in the United Kingdom. The entire purpose of the business and the business model is about putting order, safety, and security around the ticket resale market. The ticket resale market's been around since live entertainment. So anywhere that there's been live entertainment, even back in the days of the Gladiators, there was probably people reselling tickets. What was not available up until the internet days was an ability for us to build something that put safety and security in the hands of buyers and sellers. And so the way it works functionally is basically a seller lists a ticket. We don't pay the seller until after the event. We ensure that everything is okay with the ticket, makes it to the buyer on time. We manage the transaction from payments to delivery. We handle any issues that buyers may have about the event or things like that, and then ultimately making sure that they get into the event.
And you're back here in the UK where it all started. What's the purpose of your visit?
Really here to continue to educate. You know, a lot of times the company can go misunderstood. We have a lot of work still to do to continue to explain to the public about the service, what it does, what we stand for. And a lot of that is the opportunity to do that through conversations with either event organizers or media such as yourself.
And here, the framework, the background, the context while you're in the country is the opposition leader, Keir Starmer, soon to be Prime Minister, by the way, as you well know. He has taken to Viagogo in a way, in the sense that he's looking to set price caps on how much people can spend on the site. What is your response to that sort of legislation if it were to go through?
Sure. You know, being in a unique position of operating one of the largest ticket resale platforms in the world, and have done this over 25 years, I think I have a pretty unique perspective on how all of it works as far as the ticketing market's concerned. I've seen price caps introduced many, many times over the years. They're always well-intentioned. The intent ultimately is to provide more access to fans to get into events. Unfortunately, price caps don't work. You know, there's simple supply and demand economics at play. There's a lot of nuances in ticketing in general that can go misunderstood or not understood at all. And the reality is what we see is that when price caps are introduced, there are case studies and tons of evidence where it just simply drives everything underground. It goes to unregulated or platforms that don't have any consumer protections in place. So social media websites, classified listing sites, or back on the street. So ultimately, this is just going to drive all this innovation and protection that's been in place for the UK for many, many years backwards.
And it's not just politicians out for you as well. The media has been very frosty over the past few years towards ticket resale websites that say they have hidden fees and they're taking away tickets from the true fans. What is your take on that?
So there's always a philosophical debate about ticket resale and, you know, the validity of it and all that. And our position is that it exists. It has always exists. It's better to have a safe and secure option than to be let out to the, you know, sort of the scammers and the frauds and going to the street and things like that. So our position is the alternative of using a platform like ours is a better alternative. May not be for everybody. You know, we have tons of regulation in place in the United Kingdom already, you know, very long enforcements around different customer information about what the ticket listings are about. We have customer service that we provide. You know, we have a huge team dedicated to fraud, you know, monitoring all these different transactions and things. So there's a gigantic operation that's behind it. And what the general public or the media might see is a sort of a scandalous high price that can generate a lot of attention. And, you know, those tickets don't ever sell. They're just an advertisement. And ultimately, behind the scenes, there's an enormous group of people that are working every single day to get people into events. That's all we would do. That's the most important metric that we focus on. And from our point of view, again, it's about just educating and explaining to people what is the operation, what is the marketplace, what does it actually do, what does it stand for? It stands for consumer protection.
So I used StubHub in San Francisco 2 weeks ago for a hot ticket, Bruce Springsteen. He's definitely on your list of big tours this year, including Taylor Swift.
Yeah.
Now, I left it till the day of. I must say I had a very good experience. I got below face value tickets, what with it being a huge stadium.
Yeah.
And I was going to leave it to the scalpers on the door. I have seen them over the past decade. There was not a single scalper there selling tickets outside the auditorium, to my disbelief.
Yeah.
Where are they? Have they gone underground or are they simply using your services?
So it's a really good question. I'm glad you had a great experience. The United States is probably has longer term of an experience of this service. In the UK, culturally, it's a little different there as well. But what has happened is that there has been more acceptance to provide more distribution and more collaboration with both the primary and the secondary market in the United States. And so, for instance, we work with a lot of the venues and we work with a lot of the sports teams and sometimes concert promoters to improve the experience. And so what happens is that those that are looking to scam people, those that are looking to cause friction, not fulfill on their promise, you know, steal money, whatever it might be, they can't use our service because we are the ones that are ultimately responsible of ensuring that everything goes safely and securely. So when we look at the website, we have a very good idea who the sellers are. We know what their history looks like. We know whether you've sold a few or many. We know whether you're an event organizer or not. We know a lot of different things. And so those people, they go through other routes and they try to find other ways to take advantage. But most people are aware now that you should go through a place like StubHub in the United States. And I think that's part of time and education. And that's will ultimately is going to be a better experience. A, for the fan, you know, because like in your situation, yeah, waiting till the last minute's a pretty good strategy. I mean, there's people looking to just get rid of tickets and you get in really good deals. I mean, even a couple weeks ago, the 1975 that was at the O2, there was tickets for like £12 on our website, you know, the day of. So there's great deals that take place. Going back to the collaboration, there's all these different ways to ensure that you can validate tickets and you can work directly with teams to make sure that, you know, if there's a problem, we can step in and work together. So that's just sort of naturally what happens. And we would hope, you know, other countries like the UK could continue to follow suit with that.
Chris Miller, Managing Director of Viagogo, speaking to Monocle's Tom Webb. You're with Monocle Radio. It's 14:41 in Taipei, 8:41 in Zurich. There used to be thousands of statues of Chiang Kai-shek dotted through Taiwan. Many were removed after the government established a transitional justice committee to investigate the rule of the former general who was president of the Republic of China and then in Taiwan until his death in 1975. Well, now the government is pushing to get rid of the 760 representations of the contentious figure still on display. I'm joined now by William Yang, a journalist based in Taipei. William, many thanks for coming back on the programme. Can you tell us more about the history of Chiang Kai-shek and the KMT?
Right. So Chiang Kai-shek fled to Taiwan after losing the civil war with the Communist Party in 1949 and basically had been using Taiwan as a base to so-called launch his own re-invasion of retaking China. But then obviously we knew that ever since he fled to Taiwan, the Republic of China never really regained the opportunity to do that. And throughout the time, the remaining time that he was here, he continued to use a very heavy-handed and iron fist kind of way to rule Taiwan. And so until his death, Taiwan basically remained what is nowadays considered as an authoritarian state. And that is why when Taiwan transitioned into a democracy and when the current government under the Democratic Progressive Party, which is really championing the sovereignty of Taiwan as an independent state, came to power under the outgoing current President Tsai Ing-wen in 2016. They really championed the idea about seeking the justice for all those Taiwanese people who suffered and really faced persecution under Chiang Kai-shek.
Mm. So they set up this committee in 2018, the Transitional Justice Committee. Aside from moving the bulk of the statues, what was decided?
a lot of the discussion and also the decision is circulate centering around the idea about rewriting the history involving him, especially the glorifying aspect of the history after he moved to Taiwan, because at the center of Taipei, there is a huge memorial that is in the beginning to commemorate him. And most of the history in there is writing about the positive aspects, about the so-called contribution that he has done to Taiwan. So a lot of the discussion and the process is about rewriting that history, adding in a lot of the persecutions that he has committed during his time in Taiwan.
So who's for and who's against this? Is it a political fight?
Yes, it's very much of a political fight, and it's an ongoing struggle. So the people that are mostly for it are the members of the ruling Democratic Progressive Party. They are Taiwanese people who believe that Taiwan should be an independent state under the name Taiwan, rather than continuing to embrace the past of the Republic of China, which remains Taiwan's official name internationally. But the opponent are members of the Kuomintang, which continue to be the main opposition party here in Taiwan. They nowadays champion the close ties with China, and at the same time, refusing to allow Taiwan to officially announce independence.
Mm. So what happens then to the parks and memorials, and indeed all the statues dedicated to Chiang Kai-shek, and what replaces them?
So basically, most of the statues that have been removed are now being laid and left at a park where his body is left. And so it's actually quite a unique scene where there are thousands of statues of Chiang Kai-shek just laying around a lake. That's called that's basically where also his family memorial is now. And at the same time, there are still more than 700 of these statues scattered across Taiwan, including one at the Chiang Kai-shek Memorial in central Taipei. And this is an ongoing debate within Taiwan, because some Taiwanese people remain heavily believing in the fact that it's not entirely the right thing to do to remove all the presence of him. Rather, they believe that letting his presence coexisting with the current democratic Taiwan is a way to prove that Taiwan is truly a democracy that can tolerate a dictator from the past.
William, thank you very much indeed. William Yang in Taipei there. This is The Globalist on Monocle Radio. It's time now to look at the latest news in the world of aviation. And I'm joined now from Johannesburg by Gabriel Lee, Monocle's transport correspondent. Gabriel, good morning to you. We're going to start off with this story about the former JetBlue CEO, Robin Hayes. He's going to lead Airbus in North America. Tell us more.
Right. Yeah. So we've heard that Robin Hayes, as you say, will be taking on the helm of Airbus in the Americas. And this is after he left JetBlue a few months back, citing health reasons. It had been a rough time for JetBlue, kind of profits going down, and then this big failed merger with Spirit Airlines. So it kind of didn't end on a good note. He kind of disappeared off the map for a couple of months, and now he's back leading Airbus, which is an interesting and maybe unexpected transition for him.
Mm. Of course, he's been succeeded by Joanna Geraghty.
Yes. Well, the significant thing about that is that she is the first woman to lead a major commercial airline in the U.S. So that's some good progress as well. Mm.
Let's have a look at Delta. They've increased pay, but only to those not in unions. Tell us more.
Yeah, that's an interesting one, because Delta over recent years has been sort of leading the charge to sort of improve pay for its staff across the board, doing some profit sharing as well as pay raises. They were also the first U.S. airline to start paying flight attendants during boarding. Up until previously, it was only once the door was closed that they would start to get paid. But this is only for the non-unionized workers, and you could say that's partly because they have already hammered out quite lucrative contracts with the unionized laborers, mostly pilots. But it's an interesting move for them. They seem to want to incentivize not unionizing. And as a result, Delta has among the highest percentage of workers that are not unionized in the US.
Air New Zealand plans for electric cargo flights by 2026.
Yeah, this is kind of a nice one because we're seeing a kind of a potentially real practical application that's been thought through in terms of how they're going to design the infrastructure and make this work. Of course, it's still baby steps in terms of electric aircraft, which is what we're going to see initially. But they have this this company called Beta, basically, is making this rather small electric aircraft. There's actually a version that takes off like a typical airplane and also one that does vertical lift. And they're working on both at the same time. And the conventional one is a little bit more going to be quicker to market, we think. So, you know, it can fly a few hundred miles and it's going to go between Wellington and another small airport in New Zealand where they're going to just make sure they can get the charging infrastructure right. So it's nice to see that they're doing this small scale and then hopefully scaling up.
And I want to close on this story in which you feature. You were in the news on Sunday for flying classic planes in Venezuela.
That's right, yeah, in the Sunday Times. And I was sort of affectionately referred to as a jet head, which is a term I've never used before, and now I'm going to start using it. Because I went to Venezuela in order to catch one of the oldest commercial planes in existence. It's kind of a special place where you can find a number of these right now, and I managed to do it and made some videos about it for Flight Radar 24's YouTube channel. But you know, they ended up doing a piece on those of us who like to chase after these classic planes. There's only, you know, 6 or 7 of these left flying passengers in the world, so it's quite a special experience and nice to sort of have it in an article like that. It's a niche interest, but people seem to be fascinated by the pursuit of this, at least.
Well, and this is not the first time you've done it. Tell us about your trip to Zimbabwe.
Yeah, well, my trip to Zimbabwe in this sense was actually a failed one because that I was unable to fly that particular. This is the same aircraft that is in Zimbabwe. There's one flying, maybe two soon. We'll see. But at the time I went to Zimbabwe, spent a week there, and I was never able to actually catch it. They're a little bit unreliable in terms of when they're going to actually be in operation. So it was a wonderful trip to Zimbabwe, and I still got to fly some interesting planes around Southern Africa. But I didn't catch that plane then. So the nice thing was, you know, the trip to Venezuela was kind of the success. In the mission to at least catch one.
Well, and I'd love to just go quickly into the reasons why you didn't catch it, because this is a problem that besets Zimbabwean air traffickers regularly. And that's because the president had decided that he would, in fact, commandeer the plane that day and fly off to Malawi.
That's exactly right. Yeah, and I was booked to fly on the airplane. I had confirmed that it was the airplane, and I had a reservation, and then I saw the aircraft switch the day before. I just arrived, and I had to do some digging around. I found out actually, yes, the plane had been taken out of the country unexpectedly by the president to Malawi. So, you know, it happens. It's part of the adventure.
Jethead Gabriel Lee, thanks for joining us. This is The Globalist on Monocle Radio.
UBS is a global financial services firm with over 150 years of heritage. Built on the unique dedication of our people,
Hi.
We bring fresh thinking and perspective to our work. We know that it takes a marriage of intelligence and heart to create lasting value for our clients. It's about having the right ideas, of course, but also about having one of the most accomplished systems and an unrivaled network of global experts. That's why at UBS, we pride ourselves on thinking smarter to make a real difference. Tune in to The Bulletin with UBS every week for the latest insights and opinions from UBS all around the world.
Austrian painter Gustav Klimt, who died in 1918, was one of the founders of the influential Vienna Secessionist movement, a local variant of Art Nouveau. The Kiss is probably his most famous work. His highly decorative paintings are now among the art market's most coveted trophies. Lady with a Fan fetched over $1 million at auction last year, and now a lost painting has come to light. I'm joined now in the studio by Francesca Gavin, who's artistic director of Vienna Contemporary and editor-in-chief of Epoch Review. Francesca, thanks for coming in. What is the history of this painting?
It's really interesting. So it was originally painted, it began in 1917 and was unfinished at Klimt's death in 1918 when he died of a heart attack, when it was given to the family of wealthy Jewish industrialists who had commissioned it. It's a portrait, essentially, like 140, quite big, human-sized. And it was last photographed in 1925 and then disappeared. And no one has an idea what happened to it until 1960, when it emerged in a private collection and is currently being sold at an Austrian auction house in collaboration between the current owner and the Leiser family. They've done a lot of research trying to find out where the hell it's been. In particular, was it involved in some kind of Nazi looting story? Obviously, geographically, that would make sense. And yeah, it's popped up. Showing at Im Kimpski, touring the world. It's a nice picture of a young girl and it's reemerged. But basically, it's his last painting.
Mm. But who? Which young girl? That's part of the whole story, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, they know what family it is and not quite precise which daughter or which girl it is. I think that's probably less. I mean, obviously, there's some desire to have a little bit more clarity around it. But they do know the family that commissioned it, though there is some uproar because of the lack of knowledge of the preciseness of who was involved and its missing years from the Jewish community within Austria going, we need to find out more about this before you sell it in case someone else is missing, you know, crediting in terms of all of its
But it's
worth.
Not on the missing art register.
No, currently not. And also the last sale for Klimt, I mean, it wasn't $1 million, it's $109 million. So it's incredibly valuable. We're talking millions and millions. So obviously there's another level of worth here. However, that was also in 2023 when the art market was a little less volatile as it is now.
Mm. So who does it belong to?
I'm currently a private collector. I don't know if the actual name of the private collector has been released. It's showing with Im Kimpski, which is the second auction house in Austria. Let's say the second tier underneath Dorotheum. It's very interesting. I mean, it's a very typical painting of Klimt's late period, quite spring-like. Orangey background, blue kind of floral robe, young girl. It's, I mean, very sellable, very classic Klimt. And at a moment in time when I think there's a lot of upheaval in terms of the contemporary market, there's something very satisfying and solid about undiscovered or rediscovered work by someone so big. But also, his latest paint. Everyone loves a first painting and a last painting.
And it's verified. It is absolutely by Klimt.
100%. Look at it, there's not even a question about that. I think it says more about our fascination about ideas about restitution and the increasing industry around restitution that's emerged. It's very fascinating. A lot of banks and private collectors and auction houses hire people specifically to research single paintings to make sure that they're not dealing with lawsuits down the line.
How often does work by Klimt come up for sale?
Not hugely, not at this level, not at this quality. I mean, it says unfinished. You wouldn't know it looking at the painting. Yeah, it's rare that you get something of this museum level quality.
Mm. As you say, this is a sort of second tier auction house. But normally you would see this come through at one of the big ones like Sotheby's or Christie's. And I wonder why that is. And also, how you then go on to calculate that true value of art.
Oh, that's very interesting. Well, I mean, part of that, I mean, I lived on the same street for 2.5 years as Klimt's home on Westbahnstrasse. So I have a very soft, like warm feelings about the Klimt thing. I think it's an Austrian thing. There's a kind of subtleness, a quietness, a desire to keep it within the, you know, their own. The auction house, perhaps they have a longer relationship with, maybe a bit subtle. Maybe you get a little bit more personal into relationships with your auctioneers if you're going for a slightly lower run rather than the big baddies like Sotheby's. I mean, there isn't a Sotheby's in Austria, essentially. I think that's part of it. And in terms of the valuation of something like this, it's definitely based on past auction results and also how much they think they can get. Hmm. I mean, that's the whole entire thing about valuation. Things can go very much. A lot of auctions at the moment are going very far below valuations. And for something like this, it can go hundreds of millions above valuations.
Francesca, thank you very much indeed. That's Francesca Gavin there. And that's all for today's programme. Thanks to our producers, Carlotta Ribello and Tom Webb, our researchers, Monica Lillis and George Ruskin, and our studio manager, Lily Austin, and our studio dog, Bella, who's been a good girl. After the headlines, there's more music on the way, and I'll be back with The Briefing live at midday in London, and The Globalist returns at the same time tomorrow. I'm Georgina Godwin. Thank you for listening.